I've walked the hills when rain was falling, rested by a white oak tree, heard a lark sing high at evening, caught a moonbeam on the sea. Softly blow ye winds of morning, sing ye winds your mournful sound, blow ye from the earth's four corners, guide this traveller where he's bound.
A good morning to you and a very happy St. Patrick's Day. This is a show I've been looking forward to for a whole year, and a show that perhaps we need after all our troubles for the past month or so and troubles in the world. And we're so happy that Frank Delaney is joining us again this year. He was with us last St. Patrick's Day. I was almost weeping as I was preparing this morning for the program and last night with my Irish dog, Murphy, dancing to some Irish music. I had the great pleasure of broadcasting from Ireland on St. Patrick's Day many years ago, and I sit at the desk thinking, the only place I'd much rather be than right here is in Dublin on St. Patrick's Day, where the only surprising thing were the number of cheerleaders from Dallas who were in the St. Patrick's Day parade. Frank Delaney has been called, what a description, the most eloquent man in the world. He is a prolific writer. His latest book is The Matchmaker of Kenmare, which has just been published. And Frank has a wide-ranging career. He's the author of the New York Times best-selling novel Ireland, as well as Venetia Kelly's traveling show Tipperary, Shannon, and Simple Courage, a true story of peril on the sea. He started his work really as a broadcaster and worked for the BBC, covering the troubles in Ireland at their height. He did a book show and interviewed some 1,400 authors, and he's even going to give us during the course of the hour a little extra something, because he has a list of books that are his favorites that he would read again and again. And he uses the language beautifully. He is our guest this hour. We're also going to be hearing from one of my favorite poets. I had time in the north of Ireland some years ago, a couple times actually, and one of my favorite poets is Nobel Prize winner Seamus Heaney. We'll hear a little bit of Seamus Heaney. We have Irish music, and I would think we're going to have some phone calls as well this hour. You're welcome to call us. Later in the broadcast, we'll talk to John McGinnis, who lives in Appleton, who went from Ireland to Appleton, he thought, for a year or two, and he's been there for 16 years. He's going to read us a poem, and you may want to do the same if it's short. I've already had some wonderful emails. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning, Kathleen. How are you? Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, thanks, Frank, and the very same to you. Are you in New York right now?
I'm in New York right now.
Are you doing the St. Patrick's Day parade? Will you march?
I don't know yet. I have a number of conversations like this to enjoy today. So if I can get there, who knows? I might be lucky.
Yeah, I bet you have a lot of conversations. You know, there's something that happens to me in the deep heart's core, as Yeats would say on St. Patrick's Day, that there's this connection I feel, and I'm Irish, as you know, and I've been there many times, and every time I leave the country, I feel like I'm leaving home. I'm drawn, and I'm sure people are, to many countries where their ancestors came from. But what is that draw I'm feeling? I mean, I almost was crying sitting at the computer, thinking about Ireland.
Oh, Ireland gets its hands around your heart. There's no mistaking that. It does it to me, even though I have fairly strong views about my own tribe or tribes who are still there. It gets its hands around your heart, and it kind of squeezes. And the grip is both warm and cold. What it does is it affects you essentially. There's something of the spirit in being Irish. It's a combination of one's instinctive knowledge of an ancient and deep past, of a magical people who were among the first civilized people in the west of Europe, certainly civilized enough to be able to celebrate death and the afterlife in that extraordinary tomb at Newgrange,
yes,
which was built 3,300 years B.C. And it's in the national personality. I mean, Kathleen, it's a country of 33,000 square miles. It would fit into Alaska 12 times, into California 8 times, And yet, today, it paints a huge, wide, green stripe all around the planet Earth. Everybody today wants to be Irish.
Isn't it true?
That has to be. That disproportion has to be a matter not just of personality, but a matter of imagination. And as we know, the principal tool of the imagination is the heart.
Yes, it is. I had been in New Grange, Frank, some years ago, and my whole family, we were blessed to go to Ireland this summer before last, and I had this whole itinerary, and I wanted to start with ancient Ireland, so New Grange was first on the list, and we drive up there, and it's changed. You can't just walk up to New Grange anymore. You have to go on a bus, and it was sold out.
I know, but it is still, in its own essence, an extraordinary place.
Yes, it is.
It looks in the distance as though the moon has come to Earth. Mm. And then when you go inside and you ascend, you don't realize you're climbing along that long, long passageway, and you finally get to the chamber and you see the bowl where on the 21st of December every year the sun comes to rest by sending a beam of light down the long passageway. The thing about it, to answer, and this answers your first question as well still, the thing about Ireland that I find extraordinary is the past is always present. You never get away from it. Every field has a history, and there is always someone to tell you the history of that field.
Right.
And there's something about the past that never leaves you there. Maybe it's because it had to survive as an island. Maybe because it's been such a vital place for so long, with so much turmoil for so long. But whatever it is, that grip on the heart is permanent.
I did read The Matchmaker of Kenmare over the weekend.
And oh, my goodness.
I did, and thoroughly enjoyed it. I didn't know very much about Ireland's neutrality in World War II, but I love the book, Frank. You just weave these characters and the stories and the matchmaking. And is that a time in history that's of particular interest to you? And can you explain why Ireland was neutral in World War II?
Well, I was born in 1942, and they say that, you know, in your very early years, the sounds that you hear become the music of your life. And I know that I must have heard wartime broadcasts.
Oh.
I know that I must have heard the strains on the radio of the marching bands liberating Europe. I know that I must have heard the awful stories coming out of Buchenwald and Belsen and Auschwitz. And I know that I must also have heard the sighs of relief in my own family. We were neutral as a country. What else could we be? A tiny island with a tiny army and air force. No defense against anything. Churchill wanted our ports to harbor his fleets because in the early days of the war, the German planes couldn't reach that far. Germany thought of invading Ireland because it was 60 miles from England. It would have been a marvelous springboard for attacks upon England. But we had therefore to try and keep out of it as much as possible. That became, to me, emotionally very important as I grew up, because as I was taught the history of it in school, it seemed to me to make a statement that it was possible for a country, even as small as Ireland, to at least once in a while dance a jig on the world stage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we did.
And what was the American presence in Northern Ireland during the war? How many soldiers were there? What did we use Northern Ireland for?
Very important presence indeed. It started off quite small, and it was built slowly and steadily until finally, before D-Day, there were between 125,000 and 150,000 U.S. personnel on bases in Northern Ireland working with the British forces for the eventual launch onto the Normandy beaches. They brought tremendous vivacity to Northern Ireland because in came these big smiling boys who were energetic, full of life, and inquisitive. The girls loved them. But they also brought this fabulous American generosity, and they created a spirit there that made the people in Northern Ireland think, well, the war is going to end. They never said, Kathleen, all the time they were there, they never said, oh, we are ready to launch into Europe. But it was tacitly understood. And that's why I grew up. I grew up as a boy all through the late 40s and early 50s in Ireland, seeing the American GI as a hero.
And I would imagine that some of those American boys love those Irish girls as well.
And the Irish girls love them back. And yeah. Often came back to the United States with them.
Exactly. Well, I found the character of Miss Begley just captivating. And I've done a little bit of matchmaking, successful, I might add, in my lifetime. And I've always wanted to do a radio program where I would match people. I just think it would be so much fun. Is this common in Ireland? Tell me about Miss Begley and if matchmaking is common.
Kate Begley, the main character in the book, is 25 years old. She lives with her grandmother, who was returned from America. Kate lost her parents when she was 4. They died in a drowning accident nearby. She always believes they will come back, and that's how she conducts her life. She conducts her life through a combination of, as she says, faith and magic. But she lives with a grandmother out in Lamb's Head, a promontory out on the southwest of Ireland, and together they make matches for local men who come to see them in from the islands or from the surrounding countryside. But Kate talks like an animated Hallmark card. She's full of slogans and mottos. She says, what is it? She says, friendship is the photograph, love is the oil painting. Things like that. And she's full of these mottos. But at 25, she's powerful and shrewd, and she knows what she wants. She has faith in the oddest things. She's a walking almanac of useless information, or not so useless. She tells, at the very opening page, she tells Ben McCarthy, the narrator, the young narrator, who is a folklore collector for the Irish Folklore Commission, if a giraffe isn't weaned, she said, it'll require for the rest of his life 20 gallons of milk a day if it's not weaned right. Honey is the only food that never goes off, and so on and so forth. She gives him all of this unsolicited information and thereby plants herself fairly and squarely in his life. Mm-hmm. But the relationship doesn't develop. They stay neutral towards each other, and that is the point. Ireland is neutral. Can a man and a woman be as neutral towards each other? Hmm. And all the time, she is making marriages. She introduces a drover, an innocent, quiet, poor man who would never have a chance of getting married. She finds him a wife who is going to be marvelous for him, a baker who will feed him and look after him and welcome him home, a girl who wants a husband and who wants a trouble-free husband, a warm husband. She has rules for finding husbands. She asks a girl, do you want a man who has hair or bald, teeth or no teeth, silent or garrulous? And if a woman settles for a bald man with no teeth who's completely silent, then she knows that woman is truly desperate. It went on, but it was under the surface all the time because there was an element of shame involved. If a girl went to a matchmaker, it meant that she felt the world had passed her over. Hmm. And it seemed to me that the very word matchmaker had within it a freight of poignancy that could be grist to the mill of any novel.
Yes, it's beautiful. It's wonderful. And was it common in Ireland? I was touched by this story. Maybe it's the guy you were talking about who had to go rent teeth to meet the young woman that maybe he was going to be matched with because he didn't have any teeth. Did people go rent teeth?
That's based on fact.
Really?
There was a man in Catherine Street in Limerick who used to rent out teeth for weddings and funerals.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. Listen, no matter what you've heard of or thought of in the world, the Irish probably got there first. And everything we do is a parody of ourselves.
And those sayings that Kate Begley spews forward so beautifully, did your mother say those or have
My
you collected those?
My mother had a lot of them. You know,
did she?
My mother, when a local person was once given an honour by the Queen of England. And my mother said, oh, they give out those medals like snuff at a wake. That was the kind of thing. She had a lot of sayings, and so did all the people around us. There were sayings all the time. And I've remembered all those, and I've later, in more recent years, I've taken to writing down the ones that I remember. And when I've done that, I find it's astonishing how many of them I do remember. I mean, they just keep coming at me all the time.
No, I'm glad you do.
And I'm enchanted to remember them because they come from a bygone age.
Mm-hmm. Frank Delaney is our guest this hour, this St. Patrick's Day, and we welcome your phone calls. If you'd like to share an Irish memory or talk about politics, certainly Ireland is filled with politics, and I do want to talk to Frank about his time covering the troubles in Northern Ireland in the 70s as a reporter. The past, always present, are we at a point now where we've moved beyond that particular very troublesome past or not. Here's our phone number. Join us. If you have a little poem, a wee little poem, we wouldn't say that you couldn't read it. We'd like to hear from you. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Frank Delaney's latest book is The Matchmaker of Kenmare, a novel of Ireland. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Oh, and
Cherish the ladies and Ireland of my heart. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. I'm just tickled that Frank Delaney has joined us on our program again this year. We hope that he always will, as long as we're around. Our number is 800-486-8655. And let's take a few phone calls. Vicky is on the road. Hello, Vicky. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Hey, Vicky.
Happy.
Yes, hi. Go right ahead.
Hi. I'm just calling. I'm getting an opportunity to go to Ireland this fall. And my father was one of the men stationed there during World War II.
Oh, my.
Anyway, and as I'm listening, I'm getting teary here. I went through some of his things looking for, I remembered a beautiful picture book of Ireland that he had that I used to look at as a girl. And then I happened to find some pictures he and some of his buddies built. They were stationed there, or they were working on some of the British tanks, if I remember right. And they built a five-seater bicycle that they used to take to town to drink in the pubs. And I guess the other thing he shared with me was that they would eat with the Brits, and the Brits were rationed, I think, an ounce of brandy with each meal, and so the Americans got it, too. He thought that was pretty interesting.
Frank?
They had fun, the American boys. What they did was they lightened up everything. That was the great thing they did up there when they came into Northern Ireland. The Brits had come there absolutely hammered, pummeled, having been evacuated from Dunkirk in 1941, and no uniformed presence in Europe. All that time, they'd fought in North Africa, dying for the Americans to come into the war, longing for it to happen, to take on Hitler. And into Northern Ireland, into this small area, six counties of Northern Ireland, came these droves and droves of American boys, cheerful as all get out, no defeat behind them, looking forward only to having a crack at the Germans, but not saying so, and out to enjoy life as much as anything. So a five-seater bicycle, I can tell you, Vicky, was the least of it. Surprised it wasn't a 10-seater.
I'm wondering if there was a lot of writing. Ireland is a nation of poets and historians as well, Frank. Well, didn't people write in editorials in the newspapers or sit around and talk about the evils of Hitler?
They did, Kathleen. It's an interesting point. They did and they didn't. Ireland, remember, was neutral and there were diplomatic silences. And I've read extensively in the national and local newspapers for that entire period. And it's quite extraordinary what you see there. And you saw it nowhere else in Europe. And it fascinated me. It still fascinates me. You saw both sides. Both sides were reported. The British propaganda machine was reported. The German propaganda machine was reported. So every day or every week in a national newspaper in Ireland and in many of the local newspapers, you had the case of the war laid out very, very clearly. And from it, you got a much better view of how the war was progressing. No matter how bombastic the Germans were, you knew when they were on the retreat, but you also knew when they were advancing. And you were getting truths from the German reports, from the Irish newspapers reporting the German side, that you weren't getting anywhere else. Our major artery of news in those days, and I have no doubt in my mind as to why I eventually wanted to work for them and went to work for them, was the BBC. And my parents listened to the BBC, and many of the BBC news broadcasts were relayed by our one single broadcasting station in Ireland, Radio Éireann in those days, the national station, which broadcast out of Dublin. And we took the BBC feed. Sometimes we certainly took the BBC line, which was to report the war from the British point of view. Now, that meant, for example, that in some Irish newspapers, before they got any kind of military censorship going, that a major reverse for the British would be reported 2 weeks, 3 weeks, before the English newspapers got it.
Really?
Because they took it from the German side.
Oh,
or there would at least be an indication that something major had happened that hadn't gone well for Mr. Churchill. When the Americans came in 1944, all that began to change, and news was up to the minute, much more up to the minute. But also remember, nobody during the war, nobody except the higher echelon of politicians really knew about the Holocaust. Everybody thinks the Holocaust happened in the last couple of years of the war. The Holocaust had been going on since the late 1930s. And we didn't know that in Ireland. And no, I think the news of the Holocaust really only reached America slowly and in a filtered kind of way. The BBC, for example, refused to believe Richard Dimbleby when he gave them the first report from Belsen and didn't want to air it. And CBS, who were there, said to Dimbleby, if they don't want to broadcast you, we'll broadcast you. And that's how the word of the camps started to get out. So from that point of view, Ireland was in an interesting position to get a neutral feed on the war and let people make up their own minds.
What a fascinating story. Vicky, you need to read Frank's book. If anybody is going to, and everybody should read it, it's a lovely read, but how meaningful it will be for her, won't it,
to read
your book?
Because one of the central characters is an officer with the Americans in Northern Ireland, out in the coast of Derry in the mid-1940s, sent over there to set up the basis for the Americans.
Yes. Oh, I'm so glad she called. Don't you love it when connections are made like that? It's just wonderful. All right, let's go to Polly from Two Rivers. Hello, Polly. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
And to you also. I just wanted to share with you that my mother is a Delaney.
I knew there was some quality in your voice.
Thanks, Delaney. I first came to Wisconsin from Boston, so...
I thought you might have.
Yeah.
In Irish heritage there. And when I first came to Two Rivers, my comment was, where the heck are all the Irishmen? Because we were very German and Slavic up this way, and I could not pronounce the names, so they used to make fun of me. But my stories are actually from my father, who was Italian-Irish. And when my grandmother, who was a Dowling, married my grandfather, who was a Zanitti, there was a lot of controversy within the Irish side of the family, and I guess my father used to brawl in the streets of South Boston with his cousins, his Irish cousins, who would give him a hard time because he was Italian and Irish. And my grandmother used to doctor up my grandfather's spaghetti sauce. My cousin was told that she had that story with us. She didn't like his sauce, so she would go, and I guess he didn't know it, but he would doctor up the spaghetti sauce. So we thought that was pretty funny.
What did he put in it?
I don't know, because she never gave us, exactly what he made of it. He was Charlie the Barber, and he used to make the Italian spaghetti sauce, but my grandmother used to doctor it up.
There's a combination, Italian and Irish. What do you make of that, Frank?
wild breeding, I can tell you. but not at all unusual. I live in Connecticut, as you know, Kathleen.
Right.
And we have nearest a city called Waterbury, which is half Italian, half Irish. And the tremendous rivalry between them. In fact, when I was going to Waterbury for the first time to address a largely Irish audience, a friend of mine in Kent, Connecticut, who grew up in Waterbury and who's Italian-American, I said to him, I'm off to Waterbury tonight. I said, I've got to speak in the library there. It'll be a largely Irish audience. He said, bring a weapon.
Thanks, Polly, very much for the call. Here's an email that came in this morning, and it is, I'm not doing it justice because this is from Rich, who sent me page after page of Irish poetry, which is wonderful. He writes, William Butler Yeats is among my favorite Irish poets. Among his poems, Easter 1916, with its line, a terrible beauty is born, still thunders in my heart. Having sat with someone I loved in an Irish pub, not knowing, but listening to A Nation once again, stirred me to such a degree I couldn't hold back tears. And what good tears they were. The fight for Irish independence was a history to which I had paid virtually no attention until I took a course at UW-Madison, the Irish Literary Rebellion. I mark it as one of those inexplicable mistakes because I simply chose the course because it was going to be taught at what I considered the right time, the right place, a mistake which turned into a kind of personal miracle.
Well,
whew.
A lot of people have that experience. And I think if anything can convince you of race memory, of the existence of race memory, it's the experience that people have had, that I've known have had, from Boston or Chicago or New York or San Francisco, who have never been to Ireland and who are perhaps fourth generation Irish, and suddenly they find that they're listening to music being played on their heartstrings when they're in Ireland for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Inexplicably, the sad, slow music, of humanity, as Wordsworth called it, but nonetheless, definite sound that they recognize and that they're moved, and sometimes not even knowing why they are moved, but having a response in themselves that they did not expect and which they can scarcely explain.
Yes, how true. Tell me, because I want to play a little Seamus Heaney here in a moment. I love Seamus
Heaney. What are you going to play?
Digging.
Hmm? Digging between my finger and my thumb, the squat pan rests snug as a gun. Under my window, a clean rasping sound. When the spade sinks into gravelly ground, my father digging, I look down. Till his straining rump among the flower beds bends low, comes up 20 years away, stooping in rhythm through potato drills where he was digging. It's a wonderful poem.
Oh, my God, I love you. You're just incredible,
Frank. It's a wonderful poem.
It is a wonderful poem. Yeah.
And there's a wonderful colloquial line in the middle of it when the poem is moving along formally, and suddenly he arrests you with what you know was a local comment. He says, by God, the old man could handle a spade.
Yes.
Just like his
yes.
old man.
Yes, yes. And that
My grandfather cut more turf in a day than any other man in Toner's Bog.
Mm.
Wonderful.
It is wonderful.
It'll be a treat to listen to that.
All right. Well, let's do that now. This is Seamus Heaney.
Digging. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests, snug as a gun. Under my window, a clean rasping sound, when the spade sinks into gravelly ground. My father digging. I look down till his straining rump among the flower beds bends low, comes up 20 years away, stooping in rhythm through potato drills where he was digging. The coarse boot nestled on the lug. The shaft against the inside knee was levered firmly. He rooted out tall tops, buried the bright edge deep to scatter new potatoes that we picked, loving their cool hardness in our hands. By God, the old man could handle a spade. Just like his old man. My grandfather cut more turf in a day than any other man on Toner's Bog. Once I carried him milk in a bottle, corked sloppily with paper. He straightened up to drink it, then fell to right away, nicking and slicing neatly, heaving sods over his shoulder, going down and down for the good turf, digging. The cold smell of potato mould, the squelch and slap of soggy peat, the curt cuts of an edge through living roots awaken in my head. But I've no spade to follow men like them. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests. I'll dig with it.
That's wonderful, isn't it?
Isn't it? It is wonderful. And it must be so meaningful to you because that's what you do as well. You dig with your pen, don't you?
1 year, at this time of the year, we had a garden, a home garden, so to speak, attached to our house, about 3/4 acre, which is a lot to a boy. 1 year, for some reason, I think my mother hadn't been well, which is unusual. There was no illness in our house at all. My father took her away somewhere for a few days, and it was Easter. I was at home from school, and every year we had a crop of potatoes. And that year, I put in the entire crop by myself. And that poem is exactly what it was like.
Mm-hmm.
Just cutting open the ground, laying out the drills, putting in the farmyard manure, the foot-long stick by which to measure the planting of the tubers from each other, fistfuls of lime then along the drill, and then covering the whole thing over. And then at the end of May, you see the first stalks coming up. And I can tell you, that's its own kind of rough magic.
Oh, it must be. Let's talk about the North for a moment. I'm fascinated that you covered the troubles in Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. It's such a hard time in the 70s.
Oh, wow.
When you said earlier on in this show that the past is always present, is the past still present in Northern Ireland in a negative way, or have people moved beyond that?
It's both. The Irish, I contend, and I think I say it somewhere in this book, The Matchmaker of Kenmare, are the only people I've ever known who can hold with equal passion two completely opposing, conflicting points of view.
Hmm.
And that's what's going on there at the moment. Things have begun to change very slowly. For example, Kathleen, there is no longer a physical border. You can drive from the south into the north and not know when you have crossed. I know. I always know. But the checkpoints are gone. The roadblocks are gone. Mm-hmm. The concrete lumps across the road blocking the smaller unpatrolled roads, they're all gone. It's now an electronic border. But it's almost not a border at all. For example, more than 40% of all commercial property in Belfast is in Southern Irish hands. There are All-Ireland tourist initiatives. There's always been an All-Ireland rugby team. There's an All-Ireland cricket team. It's a different climate now. And part of this came about because of education. Slowly but surely, directly after the civil rights movement, the impoverished, both Catholic and Protestant working classes, began to get education. And of course, with education comes greater wisdom and greater tolerance. And slowly but surely, there's also integrated education, which means that Catholic and Protestant children can be educated together. And that, of course, is the key to the whole future of peace in Northern Ireland and continued peace in the eventual resolution of the problem. Integrated education has been bitterly opposed for many, many years by the Catholic Church. But now that's fading away. And every single year, thousands of children go to integrated schools more than the previous year. So slowly but surely, the movement for integrated education is going to have its effect on the generations. The future is always our hope. My children have no interest, my sons who have no interest whatsoever in the old battles of Northern Ireland. They just say, get over it, get on with it, move past it. Time to move on. It's the future that's exciting, not the past. I think Northern Ireland is saying the same thing.
No, that's good. Rick in Madison, hi.
Once again, Kathleen, thank you for a program that makes it worthwhile to turn the radio on.
Thank you, Rick.
You mentioned the Irish and the Italian before, and since we're both radio people, I wanted to remind you that Mahoney's mother was Irish. And all else...
Whose mother? We didn't hear that, Rick. Whose mother?
Marconi's mother.
Oh, okay.
Not sure about that, indeed, yeah.
I just wanted to say, may the road to hell grow green waiting for you. And may you be in heaven a half an hour before the devil knows you're gone.
Not only did Marconi's mother come from Ireland, but my first broadcasting in Ireland on television was from a place called Montrose, where the RTE television studios were set up in the early 1960s. And Montrose was the house where Marconi either transmitted or received his first transatlantic signals.
Oh my.
So there's a very strong connection there. And the other connection, of course, with the United States is the cable, the transatlantic cable, which came in at Valentia Island down in Kerry, went across to the United States. And that's a great saga. That's a novel all to itself, the laying of the cable.
Thank you, Rick, so much for the call. Let's go next to Dick in Waukesha. Hi, Dick.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
Canadian guest. Question first, and then a blessing. The top of the morning to you.
And the rest of the day to you. Is
that answers the question. An Irish person taught me that, and I just wanted to confirm it. And then the blessing, I sang with a community chorus here, and one night at rehearsal, the director gave us all a letter, and we talked about the content of the letter, philosophical stuff. And then, having tipped off the accompanist, he said, turn over and sing what you see on the back there. And we all started singing, and here was what it was. I can't sing it, but I don't remember the tune. But those who love you, and if they can't love you, may God turn their hearts. But if he can't turn their hearts, may he turn their ankles so you'll know them by their limping.
Oh, gee.
You know that one?
Do you know that one, Frank?
No, I've never had that. That's a nice one, though.
Yeah.
I like that a lot.
The idea of holding two completely different points of view at the same time. There,
absolutely.
There it is,
yeah.
Again. Dick, thank you very much for the call. It's the St. Patrick's Day program today with our dear guest, Frank Delaney, journalist, historian, novelist. I do want to talk to him about Ulysses because he recommends that as one of his favorite books. I've never been able to get all the way through it. I hate to admit it on St. Patrick's Day, and one of these years, I hope, before I pass from this earth, I will read all of it. Frank Delaney has a new book. He's done so many of them. This year, it is The Matchmaker of Kenmare, A Novel of Ireland. Our phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation, is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And you are listening on this St. Patrick's Day to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Shemalek ma'ilama, shemahezahilma, sona shenevorasven, akuigagen ma'ilma.
The Chieftains with Sting, Our Hero, the name of that song. Frank Delaney is our guest this St. Patrick's Day. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. I stumbled upon somewhere, Frank, your recommendations of stories to return to again and again, your favorite in literature. And number two on the list, maybe it's really number one, but you do have Ulysses by James Joyce. And I need to read it this year. I just haven't been able to read all of it. But why is it so high with you? And I know you wrote something very early about James Joyce
in
your career.
My first book was for all of those people who had failed to finish reading Ulysses by James Joyce.
Okay.
And it became a bestseller. And at the moment on my website, every week I do a little broadcast, 5-6 minute long, deconstructing the novel Ulysses line by line.
I didn't know that, Frank. How do we get there?
You just go to www.frankdelaney.com, and it's there in front of you. You just click on the arrow that's on my photograph, and it will give you... It's doing it... We're up to around 40 episodes at the moment, and we have over so far, Catherine, I can't believe this, we're heading for 70,000 downloads.
Oh, Frank, I had no idea it was there. You've made my day.
People are downloading it in thousands per week. And what I'm doing is I'm setting out to make Ulysses understandable by everybody. By the time I have finished, which will be in about 26, 27 years' time, there will not be an obscure reference in the book. I tell people jokingly, it's my hedge against dementia. It'll keep my mind alive.
Wonderful. Well, if you don't have dementia now, chances are you won't get it. We did a show on this yesterday until you're in your 80s.
An old man very happy. Listen, a happy man very old. I'm not quite sure which.
I'm getting up there, too, so don't worry about it. Let's go to Eugene from Viola. Hi, Eugene.
Good morning, Kathleen. I was born Eugene Roland O'Toole, and one of the things I've noticed over the years with the last names, the Irish last names, is they... variations in the spelling. Mm-hmm. For instance, I've seen that name spelled O-T-O-O-L or T-O-O-L. And also, I've got a friend of mine who's, I told him, I said, that last name sounds like it's Irish. He said, yes. He said, my grandfather dropped the O. And I think that's kind of a sad commentary. They dropped the O, they changed the spelling of it when they came to this country.
Yeah, there are a lot of those changes. Frank, right. Why is that?
That's because of Ellis Island. You know, when Igor Stravinsky was coming through on a visit at Ellis Island, the guy at Ellis Island said to him, the immigration man said to him, what is your name, sir? And he said, my name, he said proudly, is Igor Stravinsky. He said, sir, he said, we can change that for you. Stravinsky was then at the height of his fame. The name O'Toole is particularly interesting. I have a great interest in Irish names.
Oh.
When St. Patrick came to Ireland, the country was governed by what they call 150 petty kingships, small kings, petty in the French sense of petite. And one of the names was O'Toole. And the correct anglicized spelling is O apostrophe T-O-O-L-E. Now, the Irish spelling is O apostrophe T-U-A-T-H-A-I-L.
Oh, my gosh.
It looks like to a thale. But here's why it's important. It means the people from the countryside, tuath or tua, is the Irish word for countryside, and it is related to the German word Teutonic. It's a very, very old European name. O'Toole is as old a name as you'll find in Europe.
Oh, Eugene, that made your St. Patrick's Day. Thank you so much, Frank, for your description.
Long, proud name.
Yeah, long, proud name. Wonderful. And here's a basic question from Cliff in Brownsville. What is the historical background for this holiday? I'm not Irish, so I don't celebrate it or really understand the reason for celebrating. And I'm sure the way most people celebrate today with excessive drinking is not what this holiday is all about. Could you explain the history, please, Frank?
Well, in the States, it's very much older than it is in Ireland, actually. And it was, of course, a clutch for identity more than anything else when the Irish came here first. People completely forget, Kathleen, how the Irish came to the United States. They did not come here, first of all, as immigrants from poverty and escaping from famine. The first Irish in the United States were Baptists, Methodists, Presbyterians from Northern Ireland fleeing an Episcopalian persecution. The second Irish in the States were Catholics, and they were slaves. There were slaves in Virginia. There was a slave in South America on the Amazon River in the 1620s, and there were slaves shipped to the West Indies and then back here to the States. The Dutch farms up and down the Hudson, owned by the Dutch patroons, where they were farmed by Irish slaves.
Oh,
one of the witches at Salem was an Irish saint.
Oh,
was an Irish slave, rather. And she was an old washerwoman, Goody Glover, Anne Glover from County Cork. And one of the reasons she was convicted as a witch, because she couldn't recite the Lord's Prayer in English, because she didn't speak English, she spoke Irish. Cotton Mather interviewed her himself. You can read his own account of it. And she was actually hanged as a witch, but she was, in fact, a slave. That's how the Irish came here. So as they rose socially, public declaration of identity became very important. And I could be wrong about this, but from memory, the St. Patrick's Day Parade in Ireland followed long after St. Patrick's Day parades had been established in the United States.
And where is the best place to get all the information about Irish slavery, et cetera?
There's almost none, Kathleen.
Oh, my.
There are a few sites, there are a few places on the Internet that talk about it, but there's never been anything done on it. I started working on it. It's a difficult subject because slavery has been owned by African Americans for a long time. And the idea that you can challenge that position will take some tact and diplomacy and negotiation. But the facts of history are the same. The second thing is, of course, it was completely obscured because the English became so ashamed of the fact that that in 1625 they took 30,000 Irish people, many of them women and children, into slavery for the plantations in the West Indies. If you went to Montserrat or Mauritius or some of those islands out there, you'd find people who look African or Caribbean with names like O'Toole and O'Keefe and McCarthy and O'Connor and O'Brien and Nolan. They're descendants of Irish slaves. There's a wonderful story told about a boat from Cork landing in Barbados. And these people who look, as I say, African American or Caribbean, greeting the boat in the Irish language and saying, "Where are you from?" And the men on the boat, the crew, say, "Oh, we're from Cork." And they say to him, "You don't look like a Cork man."
Oh,
they
my goodness.
People from Cork looked like they did.
Wow. So my grandmother was a Nolan, so I could be a descendant of Irish slaves?
Easily, quite easily.
Oh,
it depends
Frank.
How long your family is here. The slaves, they stopped bringing Irish slaves here when serious abolitionism started in England in the 1700s. But at the end, from 1625, for about a century, at least 500,000 slaves were taken from Ireland. It was part of a policy of genocide to exterminate the Irish because they wouldn't reform. They would not switch over to the Anglicanism, the Episcopalianism of Henry VIII and Elizabeth I, and nor would they declare loyalty to the crown, so therefore they were going to remove them from the planet. They took over their land by sending in Protestant families from England, Scotland, and Wales. They became the Anglo-Irish, and then they removed them in huge, huge numbers of shiploads as slaves to the West Indies.
Oh, Frank, I hope you get the history for us. This is fascinating.
It's fascinating, and nobody knows about it, and it's never discussed, and it has long been a matter of some embarrassment, and I think the time is over for that to be the case.
I'm with you. Jerry in Green Bay. Hi, Jerry.
How you doing, folks? Happy St. Patrick's Day.
And to you as well.
Hey, Frank, how's it going?
Not bad. That's a native accent.
It is. I'm from Dundalk, so a wee bit north of you, but...
El Paso, yeah.
Come on. Not that bad. First of all, I want to share one of my favorite poems, A Pint of Plain.
Please.
So it goes, "When things go wrong and will not come right, though you do the best you can, when life looks black, it's the hour of night, a pint of plain is your only man. When money's tight and hard to get, and your horse has also ran, when all you have is a heap of debt, a pint of plain is your only man." That's just the first couple of verses, but
I love that.
It's an ode to the pint of plain, a pint of
Jerry, who wrote that?
I can't think. It's not...
Is it Flannery O'Brien?
I know the Chiefs have many recordings of it out there.
How did you get to Green Bay, Jerry?
Pardon?
How did you get to Green Bay from Ireland?
Well, I've been here since 1994. I'm now a working musician up here in Green Bay.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. Yep. I play as a... My name is Wild Irish Jerry on stage, so... A lot of fun all over.
What do you play, a banjo?
No, guitar and sing. A lot of Christy Moore songs.
Oh,
and,
lovely.
Yeah. I'm back to the old Irish ballads, what I like.
Right, right. I wrote a song for Christy Moore once that for a documentary I was doing about the River Shannon. And he recorded it in two ways, with accompaniment and unaccompanied. And it provided the most beautiful backdrop to the actual documentary itself. It was absolutely wonderful.
Mm. Do you? I can't believe how you can quote poetry like this. It's wonderful. Do you read a lot of poetry during the day, Frank?
I do. I have sort of various mooring posts by which I steer, Kathleen, and poetry is one of them. I try and read a page of Shakespeare every day. I try and read the Irish poets as often as I can. And I tell you why. Because what you're dealing with in poetry, for me anyway, what makes it wonderful is you're dealing with distillation. You're dealing with language and thought meeting in both of their purest forms. And that's why I like reading them.
Mm-hmm. A page of Shakespeare a day.
I try to.
Are you going to change our lives, Frank? We're going to start reading Shakespeare and we're going to understand Ulysses.
Well, Shakespeare's much more accessible than people realize. And the thing you know about Shakespeare the more you read him is Shakespeare was a countryman. He might have lived in a town like Stratford-upon-Avon. He was a countryman. And the other thing about Shakespeare is by the time Shakespeare was 11, he had a working knowledge of 6 or 8 languages. That's what education was like in those days, including Hebrew because of the Bible.
Thanks, Jerry, very much. Have a wonderful day. Jeff in Superior, hi.
Hi, good morning, and happy St. Patrick's Day.
To you as well, Jeff.
You as well.
My grandpa's brother was a Jesuit priest. His last name was Monahan. And I made up a limerick about him. He was known for having a large nose. And the limerick goes, "My uncle's name was Monahan, with a nose as big as a pelican. When he had to sneeze, you could feel the breeze from Lake Superior across northern Michigan."
Did you ever repeat that in front of that prince of the church?
Well, the family's having the big party this weekend, so maybe I'll say it before everybody.
Absolutely.
Have a great day.
Thank you. Thanks so much for the call. I had the great pleasure, we're on Christmas time, to meet a couple of Irish people who are now in Appleton. Anna, who's from Donegal, my favorite part of Ireland, and John, and they run a pub, McGinnis's, in Appleton, Wisconsin. John was born. I asked him to join us on St. Patrick's Day. They were going to be here for a couple of years, and they wound up staying for some 16 years. And so I thought that we would ask John to read us a poem today. And Frank, I'll have you meet John. John, thank you very much. Happy St. Patrick's Day, John.
And a very happy Loyal of Fodrick to you, Kathleen.
What did you call it?
Loyal of Fodrick.
St. Patrick's Day.
Ah.
Loyal of Fodrick.
The day of the Feast of Patrick.
The day of the Feast of Patrick. Oh, that's a much better way to say it. I'd like for the two of you to meet each other. John, if you ever get to Wisconsin, Frank, you should visit John because it's a lovely place in Appleton. And I'm interested in how both of you, John, how did you happen to just stay in the United States? You've lived all over Ireland and you settled in Appleton and you never left. Do you see kind of a similarity at all?
Sorry, do I see some similarities?
Are there similarities between Ireland and Wisconsin and Appleton? Is there something comfortable in a deep way about Wisconsin?
Well, Wisconsin is very, very friendly. That's the direct comparison, right? But, I mean, why I stayed, I suppose, or why we stayed was it is at the same time so different. And because we had lived throughout the island of Ireland throughout our lives, it was a great opportunity to see something absolutely different.
Mm-hmm. And, Frank, why did you stay?
Well, a friend of mine, a playwright from Kerry, is sadly deceased now, John B. Keane, a very famous playwright, said to me once, "Whenever you see a man making a major change in his life, there's always a woman in the case."
Ah.
So, shush the farm. I came over here to marry an old friend.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
Oh, did you write that story somewhere?
Not yet.
Oh, you need to write
that.
That's
a long story, Kathy.
Oh, I want to hear that.
That's
one.
That's a 20-year long story. We haven't been married that long, but we've known each other now for 20 years.
Oh, that's a wonderful story. So tell me what's happening in Appleton today, John, as we...
Well, we are celebrating St. Patrick's Day in our shop and in our pub. We have music and we have all kinds of trivia games and fun stuff like that for the day. Can I just say to, did you say Frank Delaney, yes?
Yes, it's Frank Delaney.
Yeah, I met John B. Keane on a number of occasions in his pub in Tralee years ago.
Yeah.
And he was an absolutely wonderful writer.
He was a fabulous man. He was very funny as well, you know.
Yeah. Oh, a great sense of humour, yeah.
Great sense of humour. Yeah. And terrific local knowledge. He knew every field.
Ah, that's wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us, John. Thank you. They have a lovely place there. We heard the great-grandson of the first president of Ireland. My son and I were up there a couple of weeks ago, and it was great. Oh, Frank, please be here again next year.
Kathleen, I'll be here for a long time.
Yeah. I hope so.
Good die young.
Oh, yeah. Okay, we're not young anymore. Thank you, Frank.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Only the good die
young.
Yeah,
right.
We're still here.
Frank Delaney, our guest, in his new book is The Matchmaker of Kenmare, a novel of Ireland. Have a wonderful St. Patrick's Day. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for all her work. Of the Barrow Norn Shore, of the black water, the